DW Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to Thursday's edition of Africa Link with me, Assumpta Latus.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. This broadcast is also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. So let's talk to each other on that platform so that we can have a great show.
Yeah, in the next half hour, reactions from Cameroon on the US government's decision to cut millions in security and military aid.
I told myself that, this is the right time. Let other nations follow suit. The people have been suffering a lot because of the barbaric action of the military.
In Sierra Leone, the President Julius Amada Bio declares rape and sexual violence a national emergency.
The president decided, to take a bold step to declare a national emergency on rape and sexual violence with the hope that at least this will reduce the alarming number of alleged rape cases in the country.
But first, let's hear what is happening around the globe.
DW News.
I'm Kai Dombach with the DW News. South African police said Thursday that five people died after trespassing into a disused mine, with local media reporting the deaths were caused by a gas explosion. On Thursday afternoon, at least 20 people were believed to be trapped underground at the Gloria coal mine near the town of Middelburg. Police said rescue efforts were hampered by unsafe conditions and a lack of ventilation. Staying in South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa will deliver his State of the Nation address on Thursday evening, the last before general elections in May. The elections are seen by many as a referendum on the ruling African National Congress Party. The opposition Economic Freedom Party has threatened to disrupt the speech. The European Commission predicts that growth in the Eurozone will decelerate this year by more than previously anticipated. The Commission now says that GDP will only improve by 1.5%. The Commission had a particularly gloomy revision for Italy, as its anticipated growth fell from 1.2% to 0.2% as its government has pushed for welfare benefits and tax cuts that will add to its debt. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. UK Prime Minister Theresa May is back in Brussels to try to negotiate a deal for her country to leave the European Union. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says the EU wants to find a solution, but the UK needs to be clear about what it wants.
Of course, it is also our duty to do everything to get such an agreement. That requires Britain to tell as clearly as possible what it wants, and we, of course, want to accomplish this. We must protect the integrity of our internal market, that is absolutely clear. But we also want arrangements that are important and necessary for our member state Ireland, because we are aware of the fragile situation between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Germany's antitrust watchdog has ruled that Facebook must curb its data collection practices in Germany. The Federal Cartel Office said Facebook will no longer be allowed to take data from other social media services such as WhatsApp and Instagram. Andreas Mundt is the head of the Federal Cartel Office.
In der Politik wird immer so schön so etwas wie eine Entflechtung oder Zerschlagung.
In politics, we often hear about the dissociation or dismantling of social networks. What we are doing here is a kind of dissociation and internal dismantling of Facebook with regard to data processing.
Der Daten bei diesem Unternehmen.
Facebook plans to appeal the decision. And in sports, FC Bayern needed extra time to defeat Hertha Berlin to book their place in the DFB Pokal quarterfinals. Kingsley Coman provided the 3-2 winner in the 98th minute to push the Bavarians closer to a return trip to the finals. Another round of 16 action, Schalke knocked Düsseldorf out of the tournament, Leipzig took care of Wolfsburg, and Augsburg shrugged off Holstein Kiel. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dombach.
Many thanks, Kai, for the news, and welcome back to Africa Link. Here in studio today is live me, Assumpta Latus, and
I'm Jen Nyinge. Thank you so much to all of you listening to us on our partner stations and also on our Facebook page at DW Africa, like Monju, Irenaeus, In Cameroon, I can also see Oba Oha. He says, God bless Trump. I don't know why. We also have another one here. He's called Imba Missiles. He says he is in southern Cameroon. So thanks so much for that. And we really appreciate your company. So let's keep talking to each other.
Now, let's begin in Cameroon, where reports say the United States has decided to cut some military aid to the country over human rights concerns and growing allegations of abuses by security forces. This is a significant step against a solid ally in Central Africa that is gripped by fighting between the government and Anglophone separatists.
The U.S. decision comes after a video circulated online last year showing Cameroonian security forces shooting and killing civilians, including women with small children strapped to their backs. Here is our correspondent Moki Kinzeka with reactions from the capital, Yaounde.
Military spokesperson Colonel Didier Bajek rubbished the Amnesty report, saying that Cameroon military was professional. Reacting to U.S.'s announcement, some civilians in Yaounde said, finally, America has realized that Cameroonians have been suffering. Pascal Tantor is a teacher who fled the brutality between the military and separatist forces in the English-speaking Northwest region.
I told myself that, oh, this is the right time. Let other nations follow suit. The people have been suffering a lot because of the barbaric action of the military. And I want to believe that the military proved their strength because of the support from foreign bodies. I really pray that other nations should take suit if that is the ultimate goal for peace to return to our nation. It is very clear a military solution cannot help the situation that we are going through. I just pray that even the state of Israel, let them come in. We are very, very happy and we say kudos to Donald Trump.
Businessman Joey Eric says economic sanctions on Cameroon should be envisaged by foreign states.
Actually, what the military has been doing is against human rights and human freedom. So I find it appealing, and I wish other countries could step in and do the same so as to make the government realize its actions are against our rights and freedom. So I wish other powers that have been aiding Cameroon, not just the military, but generally, even economically, should put them aside so they try to sort out their differences in the country before they can continue our support.
Cameroon is a key U.S. security partner. 300 U.S. troops are based in the northern town of Garoua to train and assist the Cameroonian military, including in its fight against extremism in the far northern region. Besides the U.S., other countries that help Cameroon militarily and which Cameroon counts on include Israel, France, Germany, and China. Efforts to get reactions from the government were made by DW, but until the time we went on air, the government of Cameroon has not reacted.
Yeah, that was Moki Kinzeka reporting from the capital, Yaounde. Now, we do have also reactions from our community on our Facebook. And you can start with the comments.
Mike Williams says the government of Cameroon has done terrible things and need to be told the truth. They should stop romancing them with words.
And Lovert Ntsadzetsa says the U.S. can do more. This is not enough. Dictators should be held accountable for crimes against humanity.
Thanks so much for that comment. Arnold Empathy says France, China and Russia and also Israel should do the same. Those are your comments, so keep them flowing on our Facebook page. That's DW Africa.
Now let's move to Brussels. With only 49 days remained to Brexit, British Prime Minister Theresa May has been told today that the EU will not renegotiate the divorce deal. May, who met with EU representatives, including Juncker today, had hoped EU would reopen the agreement to so that she could renegotiate and negotiate changes to the Irish backstop protocol.
Now, the two leaders agreed to meet for more talks before the end of February to take stock of these discussions. The talks were described as robust and constructive. To understand what that means, DW's Amrita Shima has been speaking to our correspondent in Brussels, Barbara Wezel, to explain that into detail.
A diplomatic speaker, robust means that everybody really spoke their mind, and it was a hard talk during this meeting between Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker. And this was the stiff official sort of meeting type that he usually never shows. So Theresa May got the frosty treatment here today in Brussels because everybody is quite fed up with this turn and turn and turn around of the same and ever same demands from London. Please open the withdrawal agreement. And again, the answer was a firm no.
But the interesting thing is, Barbara, both of them agreed to hold further talks. So will more talking actually help the situation and resolve the problem?
Further talks means, of course, that the EU will not take the blame if Brexit goes wrong. I mean, they're quite certain they will hold talks to the last hour of the 28th of March, if necessary, and always say, yes, we are willing to talk, we're willing to engage. So there will be a meeting between EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier next Monday with his British counterpart. And there is supposed to be another meeting between Jean-Claude Juncker and Theresa May before the end of the month. Whether all this will yield anything is another question, because on the European side, it is quite clear they are not going to blink at this point in time, because they can't see a majority for anything in British Parliament yet.
My colleague Amrita Chima speaking to Barbara Wessel about the Brexit saga.
And now to the African continent once again. And Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio has declared rape and sexual violence a national emergency. Those who rape or sexually abuse children will be from now on be sentenced to life imprisonment. This comes just days after advocacy groups reported a rising number of rape and sexual violence in the country, with children under 1 year being sexually penetrated.
Advocacy groups, together with the First Lady Fatima Yabe Bio, have been rallying around the country to push for an end of gender-based violence. But the numbers keep increasing. So what is the president hoping to achieve? Our correspondent Mutala Kamara was at the State House where the president gave a speech.
The president decided, you know, to take the bold step to declare a national emergency on rape and sexual violence, with the hope that at least this will reduce the alarming number of alleged rape cases, you know, in the country. And, you know, part of what the president said today is there will be life imprisonment, you know, for people who penetrate, you know, minors. And this is perhaps the stiffest, you know, law, you know, ever in the history of Sierra Leone for alleged rape victims. The president also said that he will create a special division in the Sierra Leone police to handle alleged rape cases, and also declare free medical service for and safe home for alleged victims, you know, of rape.
Now, Sierra Leone has the law that was supposed to protect women, but many women don't feel protected by the domestic violence laws. How is this going to change the whole thing?
You know, the problem is much more bigger. Most times, the alleged perpetrators, you know, of sexual violence and rape, you know, the police, you know, will arrest them, take them to court, you know, but over 70 to 80% of these alleged perpetrators, you know, of sexual violence, most time they find their way out. Why? Because of the lack of evidence. One of the things that women advocacy groups, you know, we are pushing for is that the government must try to get a forensic lab to help, you know, with the investigations. Because at the moment, you know, it's just your word against my word, you know, when they go to the court. So government is pushing to set up the first forensic lab, you know, to help victims, you know, to get justice.
Okay, so with those instruments, I mean, forensic lab and also for the punishment of life imprisonment, do you think that will change the mindset of people who are raping children?
We hope that this will change the mindset, you know, of the people that are perpetrating this. But some section of society believes that this is much more, you know, bigger. It's difficult, you know, to comprehend why would an adult look at a baby, you know, at 7 months old and penetrate, you know, that baby. So some people are saying that the problem is much more bigger. It has to do with psychological problem. It has to do with spiritual, you know. So government setting up the laws, you know, are fine. But we also need to look beyond, you know, just creating some of these laws.
Yeah, I was speaking to Mutala Kamara there, and I think it's really a good move from the government. What do you think, Jen?
Absolutely. It's a good move, and it's really terrible for people to engage in that kind of sex with young children.
Okay, stay tuned. This is Africa Link program, and we are live here in Bonn, Germany. My name is Assumpta Latus.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. Many thanks to all of you who have joined us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Like, we have Chrisan Fusi. He says, Bia will end up like Mobutu. You can take that to the bank.
All right. Now,
and Prosperity Jay says, Paul Bia, the modern day Hitler. Those are your comments. So keep them flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa. So still to come, A Gamble with Death. That's the title of a book by Kelechi Goodluck, a Nigerian living in Spain. In it, he talks about his journey to Europe through the Sahara Desert and across the Mediterranean Sea. So what was it like?
I can describe it as a journey through hell. It's terrible. I lost my very good friends. I almost died. I was only fortunate to have lived.
And in Malawi, people with albinism live in fear of being killed or attacked for their body parts. But first to South Sudan, World Health Organization doctors are supervising an extensive Ebola vaccination exercise of nearly 500,000 people. The virus has killed more than 400 people in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo.
The vaccination coincides with an announcement that the UN Central Emergency Response Fund has allocated $2 million to support what it describes as critical Ebola preparedness. DW's James Shimanyula with more.
According to the World Health Organization vaccine expert Dr. Alejandro Yavi Acosta, the vaccine administered to people in South Sudan has been tested and shows a high level of protection. The vaccine was created by scientists in Canada.
This is a very special vaccine. This vaccine has to be kept at minus 60 or below. And this is very specific cold chain that we have in Juba, deep freezers that are keeping the vaccine for more than 2 years. And then once the vaccine is unfrozen, that can be kept between 2 to 8 degrees, but only for 15 days.
Also in South Sudan, with the World Health Organization's Dr. Alejandro Yavi Acosta, his WHO representative in South Sudan, Dr. Olusayo Olu. Dr. Olu described the vaccination exercise as a preparation strategy.
We have installed a very good laboratory in Juba where we can ensure that we diagnose any case or anybody that is suspected. We can test them and see whether they are positive or not. We're also supporting a lot of work around community awareness, engaging the community, letting them know what the disease is all about, what they need to do to protect themselves.
Latest reports say 5 countries sharing borders with the Democratic Republic of Congo have enhanced Ebola preparedness. The countries are Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, and South Sudan. Meanwhile, the authorities in South Sudan have set up special places for screening people crossing into the country from the DR Congo. As James Wani, the Director General of Health in Yei River State region close to the DRC border, explains.
We have put a tent specifically for suspected cases. This is just for preparedness. There are some people who are coming from Congo. There are some roads, the roads that cannot be accessed by the surveillance team.
Helen Kiden, a health worker in Yei, says the government has already distributed leaflets in various local languages for people to read about the danger posed by the contagious disease. Kiden explains how people that cannot read get the message on the spread of Ebola.
For those who may not read English, we really have to train the local leaders, church leaders, on preventive measures, the ways of transmission. It needs like a teamwork for all NGOs because we are not far away.
So far, no Ebola cases have been reported in South Sudan or any of Congo's neighbors in this outbreak, which is now the second deadliest in history.
That was James Shimanyula reporting. Now, report just came in, is saying 4 people have been killed in fresh violence in southwestern Cameroon, where Anglophones have launched an armed campaign for a separate state, sources said on Thursday, meaning today.
U-Zone.
Now, for most young Africans, Europe and the Western countries in general hold the promise of a happy life. In fact, many view them as a paradise. One of them was Kelechi Goodluck, a Nigerian who is right now living in Spain. He ignorantly embarked on a dangerous journey from Nigeria to Europe through the Sahara and across the Mediterranean.
Now, Assumpta, a journey that he was told would take less than 2 weeks became difficult, horrifying, and dehumanizing, and he says he escaped death by a whisker. He has now written a book about his experiences called A Gamble with Death. I got an opportunity to speak to him all the way from Spain, and he starts by explaining what pushed him to write a book.
My book was born out of my experiences in the journey to Europe through the Sahara Desert and the Mediterranean Sea. After passing through the horrible ordeal, I go to Europe. I look back and said, no, this has got to stop, because I realized that ignorance was the main factor that was driving people out of Africa to Europe. Something that is an easy journey, that when they leave in the next 1 week or two weeks, they will be in Europe. But at the end of the day, when they enter the journey, they see that it's not exactly what they thought.
How was that journey like from Nigeria to Spain illegally?
I can describe it as a journey through hell. I lost my very good friends. I watched them die in the desert. I almost died. I had several encounters with death. I was only fortunate to have lived. I saw women that were being raped. A young girl was raped before my eyes by the Algerian military personnel at the point of gun. In the next 3 or 4 days, the girl died in the desert. We were smuggled by Toyota Land Cruiser through the desert. We were many in that jeep. It took us about 3, 4 days or 5 days in the desert before we got to Algeria. So many things happened on the way that it took me 3 years and a month before I was able to make my way to Europe. So after passing the desert in Algeria, you still have to, when you get to Morocco, you have to face the Mediterranean Sea. I made the first attempt to cross the Mediterranean Sea. We were about 36 in that boat, and the boat capsized. So many died. Only 13 we survived. The rest died. And we were rescued by the Moroccans. So where we were floating on the sea, they came with a boat and rescued the survivors and took us back to Morocco.
So you didn't even manage to get to Europe. You were taken back to Morocco.
No, we didn't get to Europe because we were still under the Moroccan territory by then when this happened. Started looking for money again to continue the journey. And on the second attempt, I was able to make my way to Europe. I'm in Spain right now as we speak.
Now that you managed to get to Spain, if you were told to take the same journey, would you?
Never, never, never. It's terrible. Some people who have read my book in Africa, they write me and say, thank you for writing this book. You know, ignorance is one of the problems in Africa. Our media houses, they don't talk so much about this journey. They talk it on the surface. I lost a lot of my friends that I had so much memories with, like the book I wrote. I've tried my best to give it out to people in Nigeria, give it out to school for people to read. For example, there are people that died in that journey. Their family up to today don't know that those people are dead. Like my friend Gabriel, his family up to today don't know that he's dead, but he died in Mali. So it's a very terrible experience.
Now that you have all that experience, what would you tell that young person in Africa planning to come to Europe illegally?
I would tell them not to think about it. If I knew what I knew today before I left Africa, I wouldn't have missed this journey. I would have used the potential I have in me. Even if I'm coming to Europe, I know that, yeah, I will come to Europe in a legal means, not by going there and sacrificing my life to the beast in the desert or to the fishes in the sea. Because a lot of people who made that journey, they have all died. They shouldn't come. They shouldn't even think about it. Their life is better in Africa than making such journey. That journey is a death trap. In my next book after this, I want to pick experiences by different people to package them in one book and make sure that it gets back to the African people so that they will read and understand exactly what awaits them if they decide to make such journey. So my advice to them is, please don't make that journey.
Please don't make that journey. That was Kelechi Goodluck, a Nigerian now living in Spain. He came to Europe illegally, and that journey wasn't easy. And now he's written a book. The title is A Gamble with Death. Kelechi says he's lucky to be alive because most of his friends died in the Sahara or the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah, and you can listen to the whole interview on our Facebook page at DW Africa.
Absolutely. And now a quick one here, because we have comments in regards to that interview. Isaac Osa Godwin says, I wonder who would pay attention to this book advice. The society now pays no attention to stuffs like this. It's now like the greater the risk, the more success is sure.
Now, Ofori David says, where's Hollywood? Arrest this narrative and put it on screen. Isn't that nice?
That's a great idea.
Speaking out.
People with albinism in Malawi continue to live in fear of being killed or attacked for their body parts. According to statistics from the Association of People with Albinism, 163 cases have been reported since 2014, but very few of them have been completed in courts.
The association is planning to hold a vigil next month at two of president official residences to push the government to do more in protecting people living with albinism. Chimwema Padata has more from Malawi.
28-year-old Kandanji Banda has just arrived in this bus terminus situated in Salima, Election District in Malawi. He's waiting to board a bus to Lilongwe, Malawi's capital city. Wearing a hat, sunglasses, and a long-sleeve shirt, Kandanji has albinism. People like him are being hunted for their body parts. He's about to make a journey of approximately 2 hours, even though he tells me he lives in fear.
Our lives are in danger. We are living a hopeless life as we do not know what we will face during the day. I only thank God each day when I wake up alive, because I do not know when I will meet my fate, because these incidents are not only occurring at night but also during the daylight.
In the last 2 years here in Malawi, there has been a resurgence in attacks on people with albinism. The government is still struggling to control the situation. Kandanji says people like him have no one to turn to for protection apart from the government and other relevant bodies.
We are pleading on government to protect us. We have tried on several occasions, but nothing tangible is coming out because the country is still witnessing continued abductions and killings of people with albinism. It is sad that our association is now being accused of attacking government instead of ensuring that law enforcement agencies ending the malpractice. We are also wondering why there is a stagnation of cases involving the perpetrators.
In Malawi, like most of the sub-Saharan African countries, people with the hereditary condition are often thought of as having supernatural powers, which makes them a target. According to the Association of Persons with Albinism in Malawi, APAM, since 2014, 163 cases have been documented, with Malawians with albinism being murdered and mutilated for their body parts, which are believed to be sold for rituals. But only 43% of the cases have been concluded in courts. APAM's president, Overstone Kondowe, blames the government for not responding swiftly to end the wave of attacks on people with albinism.
We are not so satisfied with what government is doing. Not only the person with albinism, even other Malawians, they know that government has got a lax approach to these matters.
Kondowe told DW that the association plans to stage a vigil on 3rd March at two of Malawi's state residences to force the government to look into the plight of people with albinism in the country.
That was Chimwemwe Padata reporting all the way from Malawi.
Now, for more stories, not only about albinism, but also success stories, to our you can go to our Facebook page, DW Africa, and also to our YouTube page, DW Yay. Africa. That's it for today. It's me, Assumpta Latus.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. Thank you so much for your time.
DW. Made for Minds.